eyeglasses, baby, I can see right through the ground. If you want to be a spy, then you must really see. And you must really see if you want to be a spy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Glenn Carl, who is the author of a new book, The Interrogator, An Education. Glenn Carl was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in March 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Glenn Carl.
Thank you for having me.
And do you think that your book is a very powerful personal journey of a struggle where you're trying to fulfill your oath to preserve and protect the Constitution and obtain critical information about terrorist operations at the same time aware of this country's moral standing? And you were given the impossible task, I guess, to do wrong in order to do right.
Well, I wrote the book as well as I could to be a personal story. I wanted this to be something that would live for any average American if they read it. I want them to understand what a man feels or sees or the decisions that he has to make, or that I had to make, or that they would have had to make in my position, rather than writing a dry political tome about rendition, detention, interrogation, etc. These are all very important, critical issues, but I wanted someone to feel what we have done to ourselves and the choices that we all have to think about.
And in your case, you were interrogating what was supposed to be one of the most senior al-Qaeda detainees the CIA had captured.
Yes. Well, when I was first briefed on the case, I was told that we've captured one of the top, say, half dozen members of al-Qaeda. That's a pretty big fish. We call them high-value targets, and there were very few of them. We've captured hundreds of people over the 10 years since the attacks of 9/11, but only a small number of them are the senior members of the terrorist organization. So we thought, I was told, that he might be able to lead us to bin Laden, and at the least, he would help us learn how to seriously damage al-Qaeda as an organization. So it was a very important case and a high honor to be involved in it at all at first.
But it sort of slowly dawns on you that they've got the wrong guy. And the more that you become skeptical of the notion that this guy's a high-value target and is of some intelligence value, the more pressure there is to get nastier.
Yes, well, that's exactly right. I entered intelligence is always a confusing business where you have to square the circle repeatedly, but that's the job. In this case, though, just as you say, I went from the signal honor, great opportunity for the CIA and the United States government, as I described it, to pretty quickly feeling myself as I was the one interrogating the man. I was the one sitting across from him looking into his eyes. That, in fact, he was not what we had assessed him to be. I started, even before my discovery that he wasn't what we thought, very troubled by the orders I had been given, because the orders, to me, quite clearly contradicted our entire heritage and some specific laws that we had. But I had been told, because I expressly asked, I'd been told that the president had directly authorized and ordered the program that I was being brought into, and that it was legal, even though I challenged it from the first seconds again, as being in contradiction with the Convention Against Torture and the Geneva Conventions. So I was troubled from the get-go, and then, as you say, at first I thought, I'm learning here that the man is not what we had assessed. He's not a senior member of al-Qaeda. He's not a member of al-Qaeda. The methods I'm being told to use, not only do they not work and be legally challengeable, but they're a problem from every conceivable angle, moral, legal, practicality. They just are wrong. And then that raised even larger problems, because, as you say, when the more I said, well, he's answered the following questions truthfully and he doesn't know the answers to certain other questions, I was ordered, well, and this is literally true, it will sound insane, but it is literally true, I was told the fact that he has not answered proves that he is withholding information, therefore he is guilty, therefore you must pressure him more. Pressure means to use whatever means I could come up with. And I just thought that that was crazy from the get-go. I mean, the fact that he doesn't answer is taken as proof of guilt, so the man's doomed no matter what he answered. If he answered, he's guilty, and if he doesn't, he's guilty. It was crazy.
Again, I'm speaking with Glenn Carl, 23-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine service, who retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. He's the author of The Interrogator, An Education. Now, you didn't go in there, though, with the kind of, you know, that Fox show 24, the ticking bomb. Isn't that the core defense that there is for torture, that, you know, you've got a ticking nuclear car bomb in a city full of millions of people, and you know, the niceties of the Geneva Convention simply can't apply because too many lives are at stake?
Right. Well, that's the ticking time bomb scenario is the one most dear to the neocons and Vice President Cheney's heart, and that is the justification, theoretically, the justification for enhanced interrogation measures, that you will do whatever, I was told, here's a direct quote, you will do whatever it takes to get him to talk. Unstated was because there might be this ticking time bomb, and so you have to find out the information by any means. But it's not only foolish and impractical, it just makes no sense whatsoever to base both your law and your practice, I'm talking about the practical approach here, based on the theoretical possibility that something might be the case, when in fact we know, one, that has never been the case. I don't think there's any specific instance when this ticking time bomb scenario has ever had any relation to reality. And two, you don't base your practices, your laws, your methods on something that will happen maybe one time in 10 million. What you do is you base your all of these procedures, guidelines, and so on, on the overwhelming likelihood of what will happen. And you set there's a moral, a legal, and a practical consideration to take, rather than a theoretical one. If you use the theoretical one that Cheney uses, this ticking time bomb thing, you could say, well, and I'm not making a joke here, you could say, okay, if someone takes a high school chemistry text and gets it from the public library, they might be able to learn how to make a bomb. And then they might blow up the train station and kill 400 people. We can't have that. We must remove all high school textbooks from every library in the United States to be safe. There's no difference, really, between that and the ticking time bomb scenario. It's completely crazy to do as a justification, because by that standard, the slightest hint or indication that someone may conceivably be a problem for the United States justifies kidnapping the guy and torturing him. And that's insane.
Well, that, was, of course, was Dick Cheney's 1% doctrine. But what do you make then, Glenn Carl, of Cheney's comeback, if you will? He's got a new book coming out tomorrow, and he's already appeared in friendly interviews justifying torture. And frankly, I find it incomprehensible, just as someone who tries to analyze foreign policy, that the average American doesn't understand the enormous damage that Cheney and company did to the United States, because people like Gaddafi and the Assads and all of those murderous dictators around the world who are torturing their own people are now free to say, well, you know, the Americans do it, so what's your problem?
Well, it's shocking from every conceivable level. Americans should not even be discussing this. There is no debate to have at all. Every American in uniform, officer from the general grade officer down to the lowest private, can tell you that the Geneva Conventions, which the United States literally wrote, it was Eleanor Roosevelt who represented the United States after World War II and was the drafter, the primary drafter of the Geneva Conventions, that the Geneva Conventions and rules of war and comportment in conflict, and will include the supposed war on terror and counterterrorism actions in there, Americans benefit from trying to codify and regulate behavior. One need not be and should not be barbarous and unrestrained entirely. And I argue, as I think every American would support, would feel the same way, that wherever the American flag holds sway, wherever we exert our influence, so must our laws and our standards. And if they don't, then every American in uniform or out, from General Powell to anonymous case officer Carl, can be subject to hideous treatment that we would consider, and President Bush himself denounced vehemently, as barbarous torture. And that's just simply wrong, impractical, and inconceivable. Now, with respect to Vice President Cheney, you know, there's no surprise there whatsoever. Of course, someone who advocated, drafted, implemented, and ordered and implemented the policies is not going to repudiate them, because that would make him a war criminal, and someone who would acknowledge error, which he, of course, has never done, I think, for that matter, very few senior politicians ever do. But in a matter of war, in which, as I write quite explicitly about in my book, I describe exactly what Cheney was going to do, and he's done exactly that, which is to deny everything, affirm everything, nothing is wrong, and critics are the only ones who prove their culpability by criticizing my policies. It's just there's nothing new whatsoever. And frankly, if you want to know something new about the war on terror and the dilemmas we faced, you should read my book rather than listening to the bromides and self-justifications of Vice President Cheney.
Well, do you think this is the case of the best defense is an offense? That, I mean, is there any chance that because it seems like President Obama essentially got Cheney off the hook. I mean, is there any chance
President Obama got Cheney off the hook?
Well, in the sense that, I'm saying that is there any possibility of any of these cases reaching the vice president? I mean, it's no question. I think people who know, they know that John Yoo, Addington, and Cheney and company all just made this stuff up. You were given orders by Cheney to do this. I don't know what the president was doing at the time, but the long and the short of it is, these guys are guilty, and I don't see anybody coming after them. And my understanding is that this current president decided not to pursue these matters because it simply was opening too much of a can of worms. And that's why.
Yes, now I understand. And actually, on this point, I agree with President Obama and his administration's decision. And I agree with them not because I want to protect the guilty, but rather because the most important objective to me, is to have the American public as a whole shift its view progressively back to what it was, to repudiate torture and these measures far more clearly. I'm afraid, and I explore this, I describe this in the last chapter of my book, I'm afraid that were we to prosecute any people for these actions in the government, that we would divide our society more and polarize it more, and that would not, I'm afraid, shift the views of people whose views might be changed with respect to torture. And if the cost of increasing our repudiation of these methods is to let a few people, frankly, lead their lives more or less unmolested, that's a price I'm willing to pay. I think one of the triumphs of American society has been our reconciliations and moving ahead and changing practices that we oppose rather than seeking vengeance in a way and punishing the guilty. That was the triumph of after the Civil War. We didn't have a terrible series of retributions, really. I think Obama got it right.
Well, just in closing, Glenn Carr, given that you the agency, your book is full of redactions, and clearly they tried to sanitize your account of what happened. Ali Soufran, the FBI agent who was involved in the same area that you were working in, his book is the CIA holding it up and supposedly censoring it because one of the things that Soufran argues in the book is that the CIA missed a chance to derail 2001 plot by the 9/11 plot by withholding from the FBI information about two future 9/11 hijackers living in San Diego. I take it you must have some sympathies for him. Just got a minute to go here.
I do. Well, Mr. Soufran and I have never met, but he and I, our assessments of the right way to interrogate and what we've done wrong are identical, actually. His dilemmas with the review board are identical to what I suffered through for over 2 years. And it does sound as though the only reason to keep the information that he talks about out is to avoid humiliation or embarrassment or a look back at things that we got wrong.
I thank you. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us here, Glenn Carl. Again, Glenn Carl is the author of the new book, The Interrogator in Education. He was a member of the CIA's clandestine services for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, given that Gaddafi's family, his wife and a couple of his sons have shown up in Algeria, I thought it'd be a good idea to look into Algeria. The Algerian military regime that brutally crushed their Islamic opposition over a 10-year civil war have been sympathetic to Gaddafi and unsympathetic to the rebels. The rebels are very angry about this. They've demanded the return of these people for trial in Libya. So I wanted to find out about what the regional implications are for this new government in Libya and the toppling of this long dictatorship. And clearly, in the neighborhood, the Tunisians and the Egyptians want Gaddafi to go, as do the Moroccans, but not necessarily the Algerians. So what happened to the Arab Spring in Algeria? Well, apparently it happened a long time ago when the Islamic Salvation Front won the election, and immediately the government, the military, canceled the elections, and thus a 10-year brutal struggle ensued. Laurie Brand, Professor of International Relations at USC, who studies North Africa, explained this history and suggested that there would be some perhaps further isolation of Algeria as a result of this, that there is always been a distinction between the government and the people in Algeria. And even though they're exhausted by 10 years of bloodletting, that doesn't mean that their aspirations aren't any different from the Egyptians and the Libyans. So that was an interesting analysis. And then I spoke with Andrew Revkin, who's the New York Times, creator of the New York Times' .earth blog. He covers environmental issues and climate change. So I asked him about the hurricane, he said it was indeed hyped by the press, that if you actually listen to what the weathermen said, it wasn't going to be quite as big an event. He said, however, just as much as they overhyped the hurricane coming ashore, they didn't predict the amount of flooding inland from all that rain. And that is indeed a real problem, he said. And then in terms of climate change, science the struggle that's going on, particularly with the emergence of a major climate change denier, Rick Perry, he pointed out that it's so much easier to be in denial than to sit on the couch and just accept that nothing can be done. Then the tough choices ahead, and pointed out, of course, that scientists are the last people that exaggerate. The most interesting person of all was the last guest, which is the CIA officer who was involved in interrogating Al-Qaeda suspects. And he really did have a lot to say about Dick Cheney and torture, which really blew my mind. He was quite outspoken about Cheney's criminality, and that he said his orders came directly from Cheney. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.